Great. Well, hey, thank you very much indeed for having me back. It was great to be here a few weeks ago. Great to see you all again. And let's begin by thinking a little bit about what we said a fortnight ago and then think about what we're going to do today. So a fortnight ago, we talked about how all these bits of the law that we don't really know what to do with, we do know what the answer should be. The answer should be that they somehow point us to Christ. And our job is to find out how they do that. And one of the ways that we thought about last week was that sometimes scattered around the law, there are nudges which all line up in a particular direction. And we thought last week particularly about nudges to do with death, nudges that are designed to say that God is the one who gives life, that life is his purpose for people, that therefore death is a problem. And then we saw various ways that these nudges lead us to anticipate a king who will save his people by somehow dying, not just swapping one for one, but dying a death that will be valid and representative for all his people, and that leads to life. So if you missed a fortnight ago, you've saved yourself 40 minutes of pain because I've just told you everything that was good from back then. So now let's move on from there. I want to think about the food laws, the laws that tell us what we eat and what we don't eat. And I want to think about how they teach us about world mission, about evangelism among the nations. And I want to begin by just grabbing the problem by both horns. So in Mark 7, you know this passage well. Jesus there says to people who talk to him about what you can and can't eat the following: "Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile him, since it enters not his heart, but his stomach, and is expelled?" And the Bible goes on to say, "Thus he declared all foods clean." But if you were to come back with me to the prophet Isaiah and chapter 65, which is at the end of the book and is a glorious description of the new heavens and the new earth, and before that of the judgment that precedes this, here is one of the things that Isaiah talks about God condemning. He condemns those who sit in tombs and spend the night in secret places, who eat pig's flesh and broth of tainted meat is in their vessels. "These are a smoke in my nostrils, a fire that burns all the day." So the question is, how can it be ethically wrong, morally wrong? How can it lead to the condemnation of God in the days of Moses, in the days of Isaiah? And then Jesus comes along and he doesn't just say, "From now on, it's okay." He says, "This never made you unclean. This has never polluted you. What's going on? We need to unravel this knot." And it is actually an easy knot to unravel. So what we're going to think about is, what are the enduring lessons from those laws about what you couldn't eat for us as missionaries among the nations? But before we get into that, I want to think about various ways that folks try to explain what these laws are doing there and show you why, to be honest, they might be helpful, but what they're not is right. So the first one that I want us to think about is that, the animals that you mustn't eat, they are a visual metaphor, an allegory for holy and unholy behavior. So you might be told that, you can eat animals that chew the cud. That's because chewing the cud is like meditating on God's word. On the other hand, don't eat pigs because they wallow in filth, like the wicked wallow in their sin. Now, the problem with this is that you've got to be really selective, and you've also got to be loaded with quite a good imagination, because there's zero in the text to tell you that this is what's going on. You've got to make up what the problem is with pigs. Now, animals in the Bible, they can be moral examples. So in Proverbs, you're meant to learn from the ant and the leech. But Proverbs tells you what to learn from the ant. we're not left in danger of watching ants all day and concluding that we need to have six legs instead of two legs. No, we're told that ants are hard workers and that's what we should emulate. We're not told that pigs are filthy creatures. And if you have a pig for a pet, you're probably terribly offended by the idea that they're filthy creatures. They're not. They're cleaner than many denizens of Bridgend, for example. So this way of reading it, it might lead to edifying results, but it's just not very convincing. In fact, let me quote you the great work of moral and analytic philosophy called The Big Bang Theory, where the great sage Sheldon Cooper tells his friends this. Even the dung beetle chooses to plot its course by using the Milky Way. Good. Now, of course, he says, the dung beetle also enjoys eating feces, living in feces, making little balls out of feces. So maybe you've got to pick and choose which aspects of its lifestyle you want to embrace. And that's where we'd be left if we were saying that we're meant to work, we're meant to emulate these animals in some way. Now, another explanation, which I think is more popular, probably in our circles, is to say that we're meant to avoid pigs because they are to do with the religions of the nations near Israel. And just like the pig itself, this explanation also doesn't fly. It comes from a very famous, influential German scholar in the last century. But when you look at what he wrote, you look at the evidence he gives you, all we've got is a tiny bit of evidence that in one nation's religion, they used pigs, beg your pardon, not even pigs, wild boars in sacrifices. But for every other unclean animal, that scholar had to invent the idea that now lost ancient religions from before the days of Israel must have used those animals, and therefore we mustn't. But we don't have any hard facts. We don't have any tablet anywhere telling us that anybody ever sacrificed camels or lobsters or swarms of mosquitoes, but they're unclean. And this idea also doesn't explain to us why you would ban eating a pig just because the Canaanites sacrificed them. There's a lot of overlap between the religion of the nations and the religion of Israel, for example, sacrificing animals. If you're going to avoid everything the Canaanites did, don't sacrifice anything. If you're going to avoid sacrificing pigs like the Canaanites did, then avoid sacrificing them. Don't avoid eating them and touching them. These are different things. There's no logic behind it. The third and last explanation is one that actually Fee helped us with last week, and it's the idea of hygiene. And I'm not convinced by it simply because it would work so well that you've got to wonder why it wasn't mentioned in the law. It would be such a good motivation, wouldn't it, if Moses had said, hey, you're going to live much longer lives not catching illnesses than the people around you if you eat more hygienically. But it also misses out the most obvious bits of hygiene, like whatever the meat is, wash your hands after you've handled it. Cook it thoroughly. I think if you tried to run a restaurant or an abattoir and had the law of Moses as your health and safety manual, the government would shut you down, and rightly so. It doesn't work as a way of guaranteeing hygiene. Now, those three examples of ways of trying to figure out what's going on, they've all got one problem in common, which is that they're not looking at the Bible. That they're lighting a pipe, they're looking at their ceiling, and they're thinking, I wonder what we could come up with. And what I'd like to invite us to do instead is to go back to the idea of letting other bits of the Bible nudge us in the right direction. I want us to look at how, as you read the Law of Moses from the beginning, it sets up a system of symbols, a way of understanding the world, which once we've got that in mind, and we look at the food laws, we might see traces in it there. So already from last week, we might have some clues. For example, we're about to see when we look at the passage that you're not allowed to eat carrion birds, birds that like to feast on things that have already died. Does that remind you of anything? Things that die make you unclean. Why? Because God is the source of life. And so he wants you to know that walking around in death is the opposite of being near him. So if animals as a habit hang out with things that are dead and ingest them, it makes sense that that's not an animal you want to go and hang out with. Now, that's just one little example. We're going to look at a much bigger picture, but even then, I'm not promising that I'm going to explain every animal. I'm just going to give you a big picture example of how we can learn, even from these food laws, which are normally, you know, your go-to example of why you can ignore the book of Leviticus, because it tells you not to eat prawn cocktail or whatever. Okay, so now that I've done a bit of speaking, it's time to wake you up again. So can I invite you to turn in your Bibles to Leviticus 11? While you're finding it, I'll warn Darren that I'd like some breakout groups in a mo, if that's okay. And let me explain to you what I'd like you to do in your groups. I'd like you to just fairly quickly read the passage together and forget anything that isn't there in black and white. Just notice, if you can, examples of what the text actually tells you about animals that are clean or unclean. So actual descriptions of this is what it's like to be an animal that's clean or unclean. Is that all right? And just share those with each other, and then I'll draw our attention to a few bits. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Well, I hope that was at least it's not going to get better than this. You've just looked at the Word of God, and that's that. You can probably go home now. But if you want to hang around and chat, I'm going to introduce you, not that you need to remember this name, but an anthropologist, a lady called Mary Douglas. And speaking as someone who teaches Old Testament, all of the best insights about the Old Testament for the last 100 years have come from people who do other things than read the Old Testament for a living. It's a humbling thing. She spent a lot of time looking at purity rituals in different cultures. And she then thought, what happens if I bring these to bear on the law? And a lot of what she spotted is absolutely brilliant, because it ties in with things which others had seen but not connected to the issue here. So the first thing she tells you, which you'll have spotted in the text, is that this is actually somehow all about being holy, isn't it? So you're told again in the text that this is about being holy as God is holy. And this then brings us to what we were thinking about last week, that life under the law is life in the presence of a holy God who has come near to you in the tabernacle, in the temple. And because you're living near to this holy God, you need to be a holy nation, otherwise there's trouble. And so to be not even in the tabernacle, but in the country that's near it, you've got to keep yourself clean. So I'm just going to share my screen and draw you a little diagram here, where you can divide up all of the world, really, under the law, into here is the temple or the tabernacle, and then here is the land of Israel, and then here there'll be dragons, sort of thing. Here is absolutely everything else. So you've got your sanctuary where God himself is, and to go in there, you have got to be holy. You've got to be an actual priest or a Levite, be properly made holy to go in there. But even just to live near it, to be in the land around here, you've got to keep yourself clean, because God is there in your midst. So really, the way the law works is that all of it is an answer to the problem of privilege. The privilege of having a holy God camp out in the middle of you. And so you need the Levites, you need the priests to protect you, to be a buffer around the temple, around the tabernacle, around the sanctuary, to stop a holy God from breaking out against you, because you're not holy the way that he is. And what Mary Douglas does, the genius insight, is to think about all of these random laws that all talk about purity and connect them with the idea that God lives in the sanctuary and is holy, and that this is a teaching device. See, we always want sermons to connect with us on Wednesday morning, don't we? If you're a preacher, you know that don't you dare try to make an application to our life on a Sunday, because everybody will tell you that it's got to be relevant on a Thursday morning or a Friday afternoon or whatever. Sunday's the one day on which there is not to be any application in expository preaching. Well, Leviticus does it exactly the other way around. Leviticus takes Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday and makes them all about Sunday. The whole of life in Leviticus is teaching you how to worship a holy God. So as we saw last week, you get up in the morning to make your cup of tea, and an unclean animal, a lizard or something, has fallen in your kettle and it's died. And that reminds you that you've now got a problem. There's uncleanness because of death. And that's a problem because God is the God of life and is holy and is near you. And so all around you, as I go about your day, every day, your world is being classified into things being holy or clean or unclean. And that the whole of your life is structured around a geography, around a view of the world that has got God in his sanctuary right in the middle of where you are, and which is not where the nations live. So to do a little bit more drawing for you, one day I'll graduate from primary school, but for now, this is the sort of thing you can get from me. The world of people, you can divide up like this as well, can't you? Because you've got your priests, your Levites. They're the ones who get to go into the sanctuary. You've got Israel. They're the ones living in Israel. And then out here, you've got the nations living in the nations. But the same goes for example, sacrifices. So, animals. Animals map onto these regions and these people. So you've got the animals, let's say the pig, which it's okay for the nations to eat it, but you're not going to eat it in Israel. And you've got other animals, which, you know, fish, for example, certain fish, which within Israel, it's okay to eat them, that's fine, but you're not going to sacrifice them. There's actually very little that you're allowed to sacrifice. So you can sacrifice beef, you can sacrifice mutton at a pinch, you can sacrifice a turtle dove. That's pretty much your lot. And so the categories of what you can do with animals, the things that we're thinking about with clean and unclean and eating, it's to do with breaking up your world into these three regions. The separation of the world in terms of types of people, that is to say those called be priests, the nation called Israel, everybody else, and those regions, the sanctuary, the nation, everything else. And it was teaching us that those boundaries mustn't be blurred, because to live in the land and be blessed only works because you've got God in your midst. But he had better stay in the sanctuary and you had better stay out of it, but you had better keep the land clean. Do you see? That's the way to be safe, is to not let there be any confusion about where should you be, who should you be, what can we eat, what can go there. Now, with that in mind, what is it that marks out certain animals, certain creatures, as clean or unclean? Well, sorry, again, you're going to get one of my three-year-old's diagrams. Apologies if you are 3 years old. I'm sure you can draw much better than this. But this is where this picture here, this division of the world, maps onto another threefold structure, which is how the Bible begins. Because in Genesis, by the end of chapter one, you've got a world divided in three ways. You've got your dry land, and it's got particular creatures in it that move in particular ways. You've got the waters, around it, which has also got particular creatures moving in particular ways. And then I'm going to make it green just to use a different color, but we know the sky isn't green. But then you've got the sky above with its own creatures that move in particular ways. So your world consists of the birds flying above, the fish swimming in the sea around you, and the dry land where other creatures walk about and have their being and move. You might have noticed then, if we can get back into Leviticus 11, that Leviticus 11 uses those three bits of geography to group the animals and uses how they move to group the animals. Did you see that? So in verse 2, we begin with among all the animals that are on the earth, on the dry ground. In verse 9, the next batch is of all that are in the waters. Verse 13, we move on to, and these you shall detest among the birds. So we've had what's on the ground, what's in the sea, what's above you in the sky. And then later on, they're grouped again by where they live, but now also by how they move. So do you see it there in verse 20? All winged insects that go on all fours. It's about how they move. Verse 27, and all that walk on their paws among the animals that go on all fours. Or verse 29, the swarming things that swarm on the ground. You with me? Or verse 42, whatever goes on its belly. And it all reaches its point in verse 46, where everything that we've just been told is summed up like this. Do you see it there? Leviticus 11, 46. This is the law about beast and bird and every living creature that moves through the waters and every creature that swarms on the ground. Now, when you looked at how are we describing, not what are we inferring, but what does the text actually tell you about what makes a creature unclean? The one thing that will consistently make it unclean is if it breaks these boundaries. If it's not quite a sea creature moving like sea creatures should, nor quite a land animal moving like land animals should, or an air creature moving like air creatures should. Do you see? So if you live in the water, but you don't have fins and scales, you're not a typical fish. You're not one thing or the other. You've broken a boundary. You're unclean. You fly in the air, but you don't have the kind of legs that birds typically do. You're unclean. You've broken a boundary. You've broken out of your category. You don't move in the way that things that live in the sky or land or sea are supposed to move. You've broken the boundaries that divide those three regions, sky, earth, and sea. And so marking these out as unclean, how is that a reminder about holiness and purity? Well, because of the relationship between those two types of geography. That on the one hand, in Genesis 1, you've got three geographical regions which are being told not to cross. And then in Genesis 2, we begin to see what we've described, where you've got your sanctuary, your garden in Eden. You've got your land, the land of Eden. And then you've got the rest of the world, which still needs to be gone and looked after. And so those two sets of the world breaks down into three categories. That is how the Bible begins and shows us how to see the world if you're living under the law. And then the law uses these animals to say, you've got to respect the boundaries of this region. Let me just stop sharing a moment. Don't go wandering into the sanctuary if you're not holy. Don't go living near the sanctuary if you're unclean. If you become unclean, you need to go out of the camp and you need to sort that out before you can come back in. So those sharp divisions are absolutely vital. And so much of the law is about keeping those clear. And one way that that is reinforced is by saying, look, don't even eat things that look like a visual illustration of breaking out of the region that you've been put. Don't wander into the sanctuary if you're not a holy Levite. And if you're in the land, keep yourself clean and don't start to live like the pagan nations that are outside the outer boundary. So all of this was to help Israel understand and visualize through a particular way of arranging the universe, something about God. Let me just quote Mary Douglas for you, because she really is brilliant. In the Old Testament, remember, she's brilliant because she's not an Old Testament scholar. That is the sure mark of knowing what you're doing, is that you don't earn a living by it. In the Old Testament, we find blessing as the source of all good things, and the withdrawal of blessing as the source of all dangers. The blessing of God makes the land possible for men to live in. Let me say that last bit again. The blessing of God makes the land possible for men to live in. And so the food laws and all of these other laws are about reinforcing the boundaries that mean you may live in the region that in its heart has got God living in the sanctuary. And that is why you're going to be blessed. Why so much faff? Why so many nudges? Why so many laws about that? Well, you know about the couple who went to marriage counseling, the wife dragging the husband along. And, the counselor said, what's the problem? And the wife complained, you know, he just never says that he loves me. And the husband shrugged and said, I told you that I loved you the day that I married you. And I assure you that if ever I change my mind, I will let you know. And God in the law is the opposite. You know that it would be bonkers to be told, I love you until further notice. You know that you've got to keep telling your mother, your husband, your wife, your children, your brother, I love you. And even if you're British, by the way, this is not optional, but you've got to go further than that, haven't you? You've got to arrange your life in such, I can see various English people cringing, they're not coming back, are they? You've got to arrange your life in a way that creates an environment that actually says, I love you. You know, so if that door behind me spends all day shut, then I can tell my students that I love them until the cows come home, but I'm telling them that I don't want to see them. And that's why that door is normally wide open. I could tell my children all I want that I love them, but if playing with them is always less important than anything else I can dream of, I'm wasting my breath. And that is how Leviticus work. Leviticus doesn't simply say to you, I've got a message, I've got a thought to put in your head, write it down. God is life-giving. God will bless you. He's also holy and dangerous. No, Leviticus arranges your whole life to press that point home. To press home the fact that you live by the blessing of a life-giving God who loves you. Now, what I want to do is build a little bit on this idea. If these boundaries and if the food laws are about reinforcing boundaries, if the boundaries are about the dangerous privilege of living near God who gives us blessing, then I want to go a bit further than Mary Douglas does and ask, well, what about region number three? What about the nations? What about those who are living far from life in the region of death? Those who are in desperate need of life, of blessing, how do they get to approach the holy God? And that brings us back to where we started. What was Jesus doing when he said, I know what Isaiah said. I know that he said that you're going to hell if you do this, but you know what? It's never made you unclean. Does that mean that Jesus no longer cares about the holiness of God? Is he saying Moses was all about holiness? No, I'm here to tell you about a friendlier bearded God with carpet slippers. No, I think this is where, again, the work of this lady, Mary Douglas, has been so helpful. Those laws were teaching beyond themselves. Those laws were doing what Jesus said they were doing. They were somehow not about themselves, but about him. And in that sense, it's okay if they were almost arbitrary. It's okay to realize that it was never wrong in itself to eat any particular food. It was not an ethical thing. Rather, giving you these laws about what you can eat was a teaching tool. It was a way of sorting out your understanding of yourself in the world in relationship with God. That's why Paul tells us in Galatians 3, the law was our teacher, our instructor, our guardian, our tutor, when? Until Christ came. So these laws were there to teach something. But what was it? What is it that we still need to know that those laws were teaching? What were they doing about the nations? We've seen what they do about the sanctuary. We've seen what they do about the land of Israel. What about the rest of the world? Well, it's interesting. In the law, Deuteronomy 14, Israelites were told that it's okay to take meat from unclean animals that you can't eat and sell it to foreigners or give it to sojourners. So Moses always said that it's not morally wrong to eat this food, but you had better not do it. Okay, so the Israelites knew that even though they would be condemned for eating pig's flesh, the law itself told them, no, it's not an ethical thing. It's not like murder. If Jesus had come along and said, from now on, murder is okay, we'd be thoroughly confused. We would not be able to make sense of the law. But for Jesus to come and say, hey, the food laws have reached their expiry date, that shouldn't be a surprise because of what the law says. So I want us to think, and we'll end there. What is it that changed? What is it that changed between the law in the days of Isaiah and the days of Jesus? And what changed are the circumstances in which God's people are God's missionaries. In the days of Isaiah, Israel's mission was to be a light to the Gentiles, a distinct nation in its own land, a showcase to the nations, but not penetrating the nations. Stay put, and they might watch you. And then one day, the word became flesh and made his tabernacle right here among us. No longer do you need Israelites, Levites, to surround the tabernacle to protect the Gentile nations in case they end up approaching a holy God. No, now God himself has indwelt human nature and is able to go around and see a Canaanite woman with a sick child or a demon-possessed child and touch her and heal her, and it's fine. And do you notice how when this Canaanite woman comes and says, will you heal my child? What does Jesus initially, what's his opening gambit? It's not okay to give the food, the bread of the children, and give it to the dogs. And she quickly picks up on, but can't we eat crumbs from your table? He's using food to teach something about the mission that he came on to the people. So the very food laws that were designed to reinforce that division between the sanctuary in the middle, the land of Israel around it, and then the whole world, if we were to keep them now, we'd be missing what Jesus came and commanded Israel to do, which is to leave. It's to go out of the land, from Jerusalem to the ends of the earth, go into every nation, transform people into the image of Christ, so that he will have many brothers that are shaped from one degree of glory to another. Okay, let me try and sell you this idea a little bit more. We quoted Mark 7 at the beginning, all foods are clean. Peter was there. He didn't get it. The penny didn't drop. We know later on in his life in Acts, he's in trouble with Paul because, you know, he's refusing to eat hot dogs or whatever it is. So what did Jesus do to make the penny drop for Peter? Well, seconds before commanding Peter in the book of Acts to go out to the nations, what happens to Peter? He's on the roof of a house. He's never eaten any unclean animal. And Jesus comes to him in a vision and shows him all these unclean animals and says to him, eat them, and tells him, what God has made clean, do not call common. I'm in Acts 10, chapter 15. So there he is being told to eat unclean animals. And we're told, very next thing, verse 17 of Acts 10, while Peter was inwardly perplexed as to what the vision that he had seen might mean. So he's asking himself, what do the unclean animals mean? And we're told, behold, the men who were sent by Cornelius, Gentile Cornelius, foreign Cornelius, Cornelius from the nations, are right there wanting to hear the gospel from him. Do you see? Jesus doesn't say to Peter, look, the ceremonial laws are inconvenient. Put them away. They're going to be off-putting for the Gentiles. Forget our diet because it will hinder your mission. Eat pork scratchings from now on because then you'll find it easier to evangelize in pubs or whatever it is. You know, be all things to all men. True though that might be, Jesus goes deeper than that. Jesus says to Peter, what God has made clean, do not call common. It's not pragmatic. It's a deep application by Jesus of the upgrade in the mission of Israel, the mission that Jesus has been given. So in Isaiah 49, you all know it, a very often quoted passage, Jesus is addressed like this. He is told, it is too light a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to bring back the preserved of Israel. I will make you as a light for the nations, that my salvation may reach to the ends of the earth. And if we, the body of Christ, are to live among the nations, then it's not enough to say that food laws would be inconvenient. It's more than that. Food laws would reinforce the very thing that is no longer true. Food laws would reinforce that we ourselves have to stay away from God and that the nations need to stay away from us and therefore from God. So let me put it like this. What should we think? How should the food laws help us now? When you tuck into bangers and mash, when you ladle down the crab chowder, when you saute, when you prepare your vulture casserole, you no longer think to yourself, I must be separate from the nations and be holy as God is holy. No, you now have a reminder of our new situation compared to Israel. You look at this food and you think to yourself, these animals used to be unclean because they crossed boundaries. And now they are clean because we are to cross boundaries. We are to cross physical boundaries. We are to cross geographical borders so that the light of Jesus will shine among all the nations. You also think to yourself, okay, this thing crosses boundaries. That used to be forbidden. I'm still supposed to be holy as God is holy. Just as much zeal as I will show in crossing land and sea and crossing geographical boundaries, I will show that same zeal to be distinctively holy, to be distinctively a member of the body of Christ, to be like Jesus, as much like Jesus as the unconverted are unlike him. I will be ethically, morally, in my character, distinct, will be as different in my character as Jesus is from Satan, as the land is from the sea, as the sky is from the land. I will let this, what is it, prawn cocktail, remind me that the lost are far from the blessing of a holy God, a life-giving God. And so I will go to them, but I will go to them keeping myself ethically clean. And I can do that because when I walk around them, the one thing they're no longer is ritually unclean. They can't pollute me. It's safe to go to them with the gospel. I'm sure that was all completely clear, but does anybody, and convincing, but does anybody want to humour me by asking any questions? If so, I'll hang around a bit and Darren will stop us, call us to order, and tell us to pray for my sanity when ready.
Well, they have a deeper level of confusion by the sounds of it, Stefan. I've won.
I've broken everybody, haven't I? Yeah, I do that. There we are.
One question would be, you mentioned about food. Food does come up in Acts when it talks about blood. Mm-hmm. And so for those of us of Northern or Scottish descent, and Spanish for that matter, with Bafia, people tend to try and get around that. And so is blood okay, because it mentions it alongside sexual immorality. So it sounds different there. Is all food clean?
Yeah, you know that caveat I gave you at the beginning where I said I'm not going to answer every question about every law that's to do with food in Leviticus. Can I cash that in now?
Yeah, that's fine.
I do think the text of the Council of Jerusalem is opaque, and refrain from strangled things, meaning what? Some even think it's prohibiting euthanasia, child abandonment. You have a child that's sickly, you strangle it to death. Typical thing, abstain from bloods. Doesn't say eating bloods, it just says from bloods. Meaning what? I don't think the understanding of the church has reached a point where I can claim to give you a definitive answer without three people shooting holes in it. So, but I will say it's not in Leviticus 11. And if this is about food, if Acts 15 is about blood in your black pudding, the logic for not eating blood in the law is not the same logic that I've just outlined. The logic is that don't eat it because of the lifeblood is in there. So whatever it's teaching you, it's a different point than maintain your boundaries and separations. What the point might be, well, I'm not entirely sure. I can give you a punt, but even then, I don't think I can tell you that that's what's going on in Acts 15.
There's another question. I think it's coming to your box.
So the question is, can we apply this to all of the ceremonial laws? And is this the reason why all of the ceremonial laws are not fulfilled, etc.? I think you probably meant now fulfilled, etc. Do you want to nod and own up if that's what you meant? Yeah. No. So what I was trying to say two weeks ago was that there are different, many, many different and glorious ways that once you see Christ, you realize the law was preparing you to recognize him. And so the geography that I've just given you and the ideas of holiness, that does explain, it does a lot of work for you. So, if you haven't come across this before, you probably have if you sit under Andy and Darren's preaching. But if this is new to you, pick up Leviticus or Exodus or Numbers or Deuteronomy, and you'll see that it begins to make sense of a lot of things. But it's not the one holy grail behind every last detail. There are going to be other nudges that we haven't talked about yet that are telling you other things about Jesus.
And that relates to something I think it was Andy who asked last time that you dodged so why that you then have laws that you as well explained as you just have laws that don't apply, and then laws we go, well, of course we don't do that. It says so in Leviticus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you're talking about, I've talked about these as ceremonial laws. Where does that idea come from? Why is that okay? Listen, invite me back anytime. But I don't think we can cover that in in question time without stretching babysitters and bedtimes.
Well, as people from CPC and Oxford asked before, maybe we'll do that at some other time.